Welcome to the American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Chalmers, a shoulder and elbow surgeon at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Rachel Frank, a sports and shoulder surgeon at the University of Colorado in Denver. Rachel, how are you?
Pete, doing absolutely fantastic. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Before we get started, I should mention that the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons, the University of Utah, the University of Colorado, or the Florida Orthopedic Institute. Today, we have our annual ASES President's Interview episode. It is thus my great pleasure to welcome to the podcast Dr. Mark Frankel. For most listeners, Dr. Mark Frankel will need no introduction. Dr. Frankel is at the Florida Orthopedic Institute in Tampa, Florida. While he's made numerous major contributions to our field, he's best known for the lateralized reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. This innovation, which he developed and then thoroughly demonstrated the benefit of, has revolutionized our thinking about the optimal way to perform what has become one of the most common operations within shoulder surgery. While Dr. Frankel has served many important roles within our organization, he is just now completing his ASES presidency. Dr. Frankel, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Rachel, for having me.
Dr. Frankel, I hope you might tell us from the beginning, how did you decide to become a shoulder surgeon? How did you get started in this business?
I liked shoulders during residency, but, you know, when I trained in the 80s, there really wasn't very many subspecialists. So it was a unique thing. And, I had a slightly different background in that I got really interested in research in medical school. I had a mentor in medical school that sort of said that, you know, to become a medical student, you have to get really good grades. And to be successful in medical school, you have to get really good grades. But you really never learn how to critically think, nor do you really learn how to read a journal article. And he offered this fellowship between my second and third years of medical school, which was basically independent learning, but really a focus on research methodology. And I really became excited about it and really interested in it. And when I did my residency at University of South Florida, and my mentor here was a guy named Phil Spiegel. And Dr. Spiegel is an interesting guy. He was in private practice for a while. He was University of Chicago, went to USC, and then he came back and started the program at the University of South Florida in the 80s. And one of the things he did is when he finished his residency in the 60s, he went to Davos and spent a year in Davos. And when he came back, he was one of the people that introduced internal fixation with modern techniques to the United States. And before that, you know, internal fixation, it was really questionable whether it had sufficient improvement to warrant it over traction and casting. So for those of us who can't imagine doing traction and casting, that was what orthopedic surgeons did mostly until this revolutionary change. And Dr. Spiegel felt that that year of research really made his career. And during my residency, he knew I was one of the few residents that did research in our program. I just really liked it. And he sent me there when I finished my residency. And before I went there, again, it was in Switzerland. So I had to sort of make a decision of what I wanted to do. And again, that was unusual. So I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I knew what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to do hand and I didn't want to do spine. I just didn't really like those subspecialties when I was rotating during my residency. But I really wanted to work with someone who was a key opinion leader. I really thought it would be interesting to see how people who really really made an impact in our field, what they did and how they worked. So I went and I interviewed Henry Mankin, who was at the time the head of tumor at Mass General. Bert Zarens had a sports program that I interviewed there. And then I interviewed at Mayo, and I met with Bob Cofield and Bernie Moore, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. I can work with two thought leaders. And at that time, Sean O'Driscoll was in the lab, and he was doing his study on the PLRI, and he was so excited. I went down, I saw it. He goes, Mark, look at this. It's so cool. And I was sort of hooked. I wanted to work with those guys. So that was really, it was that really forced me or made me decide. It was those individuals that really shaped my professional life, and they still do to this day, is Dr. Cofield and Dr. Morey.
Well, what a history. And I think all of us are thankful you decided to end up with shoulder surgery after all of that. How did you settle in on Tampa? What made that your place and what has kept you there for so long?
Well, that was sort of easy. So I was in Chicago. I went to med school there, and it was the coldest winter in history. My car was frozen solid for 3 weeks straight. I kid you not. I couldn't get my apartment above 40, and I had the rank list, right? We had to submit our rank list at the end of December, January, I forget exactly when. And initially, the two most popular programs in my mind was the Mayo Clinic and the University of Iowa, and I sort of hard between those two. But it was so cold, I thought, I must be nuts. Why would I do that? So I switched the programs. I put San Diego 1 and Tampa 2, and I came to Tampa, and I just loved Tampa. There was just everything about it. The faculty, they were great. They sort of let me do, like I mentioned Dr. Spiegel. He was very much like, I want to do research. So he's like, go for it. So I went to the VA, and I did some studies on rats, and then I was interested in anabolic steroids. That was sort of the other thing I studied during that year. And so I did a bunch of different studies in that. It was sort of an interest. And then I got interested in infection. So I did some studies on that. But it was really, there was a lot of autonomy and freedom. And I really liked that about the program. And I loved the area. So then when I finished I did three fellowships, two in research, one at Rush. That independent year where I spent time with a guy named George Galante. And George, he was the one who sort of discovered that bone could actually go into metal if it was the right particle. So, you know, up until then, total joints were all cemented and, you know, there was cement disease, which is what they call loosening or wear disease at that time. And so there was a great desire to try to attach implants without cement. And George discovered that a certain pore size of metal was ideal to have bone grown into it. And I worked in his lab, and we worked on different things to enhance bony fixation during that year. And then I went to Davos and did a year of research doing biomechanical research on fractures and fixation, right? So those are two areas that I'm just intrinsically interested in. And so when I was looking around when I finished my last fellowship, which is the clinical fellowship at Mayo, I looked at Tampa, I looked at some other programs, but I wanted to be a place where I really would have a similar autonomy, where, you know, I would be able to do things the way I wanted. And I knew early on I wanted to be an academic orthopedic surgeon, I for whatever reason, like, you know, early, really, really early on. But my residency underwent a real political misfortune. And many of you aren't even aware of it, but what happened was they fired our chairman, and as a result, the entire department left the university, and they left the day I graduated, as it turned out, which the guys below me got screwed, and they formed a private practice group. And the university never, until recently, had an orthopedic program. So we sort of were a private practice group in a town where there was no other orthopedic group. And that was appealing to me, that I can come back and join these guys, and they would be very supportive of any research endeavors that I did. And in fact, they were extraordinarily supportive. In fact, for a long time, we had a 4% tax of our gross clinical revenue that went to a research budget. And there weren't many people that did research. I was doing research. Roy Sanders, his my partner, a well-known traumatologist, was doing research. But every year, these guys would put in the money until maybe 10 years ago. And that allowed me to pursue this vision I had of being an academic orthopedic surgeon, where I could be in private practice, but I could certainly do what I hoped would be significant academic contributions. And I really wanted to do things in basic science as well as clinical research, because in my mind, that sort of separated a true academician.
Can I ask you one question about that? I'd heard that story before about what happened with the Florida Orthopedic Institute, and I know how it's kind of changed everything in your area. Was there no non-compete in your contract? How did that? Was it? It sounds like you were not there at the time, and maybe you joined.
I'm telling you, it was amazing. It is something that it couldn't happen in today's world, because, you know, the thing that I learned, and maybe this is not true, so I'll preface it and saying it might not be universal, but you know, my desire to be an academic orthopedic surgeon was, I was sort of driven by curiosity and by the pursuit of gaining knowledge and sharing that knowledge within the field. And I imagine that was the goal of a university. And at least at our university, it was a little bit more complicated because money came in and power. So money and power changed our dynamic. And it was sort of amazing because the university lost so much revenue by letting the orthopedic group leave. And it really had to do with the sort of personalities at the time. They had hired a new vice president of the university who sort of had this vision that all medicines should be integrated and that the subspecialties that were paid the most, they should contribute more to the subspecialties that pay the less. So sort of a very socialistic view. And you know, that sort of didn't sort of jive with the department and their belief. They were trying to build an institute on the campus. They wanted to hire basic science researchers with the revenue that they were gaining. And that sort of that continued with the 4% money that they gave from gross revenue. But at that time, there weren't any non-competes. No one really thought that much. It really made no sense. I mean, not only they left, but all their patient records came with them, right, when our group formed. Because all these guys worked at the university, so there wasn't any of that. I mean, it was just a power play that they couldn't believe that these guys would just leave their job and start afresh. And for the first couple of years, I mean, there was a lot of financial turmoil. You know, at one point the overheads were 90% because we didn't know what the hell we were doing. So, I mean, there was a lot of things in retrospect, but, you know, things have changed so dramatically in the 30 years since then that it probably couldn't happen in that same way in any place.
Certainly, it's a fascinating story. So you've done all of these fellowships, all this basic work to, you know, develop your critical thinking, understand the biology of, you know, bone implant ingrowth, and so then you join this private practice group that has this academic bent, and you start doing shoulder. Tell us from there, how did you get the idea for what would later become the RSP or the lateralized reverse total arthroplasty?
So there's so many great stories. So the first thing I'd say is, you know, I did the research fellowships because unlike Joe Iannotti that had a very specific planned method of how he's going to pursue his scientific career, I did it because I really liked it. I mean, there was no other reason. And in fact, when I finished my fellowship in Davos and I was driving around, I thought, this is a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it, but I don't imagine this to do anything for my career, right? And I say that because if anyone's out there listening and they think that they're doing some educational activity, maybe a fellowship or maybe a year abroad or something, you never know how that may change your financial future. Because arguably, what I learned from those two fellowships, those year-long fellowships in research, they later become sort of the real basis for the design that I developed. And it all made perfect sense in terms of how I imagined it would work. There was no question in my mind that it would work because I sort of built up this background of basic science knowledge about bony ingrowth and internal fixation. So, you know, that's sort of how it started. And the reason it started was, you know, I finished my fellowship. I joined this group. My group is very supportive. They're like, look, Mark, we're going to send you all of our shoulders, which in the 90s, it wasn't a ton, but it was some. And I had these patients that had, you know, massive cuff tears or cuff tear arthropathy. And I did hemiarthroplasties because that's what I was trained to do. And not only did they not do as I expected, but many of those people actually got worse. They developed erosion of their glenoid, they have erosion of their acromion. And so I sort of early on, you know, now like in the 1994, 95 time period, you know, I was asking the experts in the American Shoulder Elbow Society, and they really didn't have very compelling answers. Some of them said they'd never seen the complications I was describing, so that made me wonder if I was doing the operations correctly. And then I went to the International Conference for Shoulder Surgery in Sydney in 1996. And one of the presentations was, I don't remember who, but it was one of the French guys that was showing the outcomes of the Grammont. And I was blown away. And I walked away thinking, this is amazing. And I sort of got, I'd seen the, you know how at the Academy, they had these small little vendors. And I remember stopping and getting one of the vendors they had, the Grammont at that time. But I didn't really think much of it. And then Tonier was launching the Aqualis anatomic shoulder in the 1997. And so they asked me if I would visit Pascal and Jill, the designers of that implant, for a week. And I said, sure. And that really changed my life tremendously. You know, those guys were really gracious. They were really nice. And I'd go watch them operate, and they were master technicians. And then afterwards, we'd go out at night, and I would just pepper them. I had a recorder. I recorded everything they said. And I was talking with Jill, and I was telling him about these patients. And he said, you know, there's this guy, I don't really know how this implant works, but it works. And he was talking about the Grammont implant. And so I had a picture of that. And when I came back from that visit, I at that time I was on a design team with Mike Pearl and Greg Nicholson with a company called Howmedica, which is a big manufacturing company that made the PCA hip and knee, which is really popular at that time. And so we were going to design their shoulder system. So I went to their engineer and I said, I'd like you to make me a custom implant. I gave him the picture of the Grammont device that I had from the brochure. It was in French, but the picture was there. I said, make it look like this. So he gave me this implant. It looked nothing like that. It actually had a lateralized sphere, and I did it, and it failed on the humeral side really within 3 months. So the story is hysterical, because at that time, I get fired from my design team from Greg and Mike, and Mike tells me this at the Academy in New Orleans. I never forget it. Like, I couldn't believe I was getting fired from this design team. But I guess they thought my ideas were too radical, I guess. I'm not sure. And then I tried to find the engineer from Howmedica. And when I called the company, they said they couldn't find him. He left or something like that. So I really didn't quite know what to do at that point. But there was a small company, Encore Medical, and I was using their implants. And they were really supportive. They're like, look, we can help you do whatever you want. So then I started to sort of iterate off of the implant, because I sort of had an idea that it looked sort of okay. And at that point, Mark Mile was my fellow, and Mark speaks like 6 languages fluently, including French. So again, in the 90s, you guys can't imagine this, but it was a really pain to get articles and journals. But I got these articles in French on the reverse prosthesis, and Mark was reading to me. We made notes at my house, and they talked about notching. And I thought, well, geez, why don't we just move it away? And that was sort of the beginning. So I have this talk where I go through the iterations. So in 1998, I ended up doing like 9 reverses. They all were lateralized. They all looked a little bit different. My initial thought was to have a platform system. I wanted it to be, you know, everything would be the same. I wanted to learn one operation. I wanted to cut the head in the same degree of inclination and retroversion on all of them, because I thought I don't have to learn. It'll be too confusing to learn too many. And in 1999, I had a post on the original base plate, and I thought, you know, I did that work at AO, and that lag screw, it's a 6.5 lag screw that exactly mimics the AO 6.5 screw. And I thought, well, why wouldn't I just do that? Because I'll get great compression between the metal and the bone. And that's what I did. And the first time I put that in was a cadaver lab in Tampa during my Tampa shoulder course. We had a breakout system. And I put that thing in, it was rock solid. And John Fenlon just happens to walk in and says, what are you guys doing? I said, I'm making this implant. He goes, what's it for? And I said, well, I think it's going to be for cuff tear arthropathy. And he sort of laughed and walked out. He said, well, good luck with that. But right then, I really felt there was something just perfect about that because it was so simple, so easy, and so stable. I mean, it was like, I was like, okay, well, this is done. And I really thought it was done. But I learned a few things. It wasn't quite done. But that's sort of the background of how I started with a reverse. Some of it was accidental. Some of it was looking at the notching, thinking we could design around that by using a lateralized sphere. And then the enhanced fixation was something. It just was so obvious to me intuitively that a fixed angle device that had a compressive lag screw would be ideal for fixation. It just sort of turned out to be true. And that was in 1999. And basically, the base plate has not changed in that time period. We added some features, like now we have lock screws that are 5 millimeters instead of the 3.5 non-locking screws, but that was basically not changed, really.
It's a fascinating story because there's was such this dogma that the problem with the base plate had to do with the lateralization, and you needed to medialize, and you tell the story about how really it was a fixation issue, and I think that was such an interesting insight that certainly required all that background you had working with AO. I wanted to transition a little bit to talk about your ASES presidency. You know, we're at the very end of your year. I'm sure it's been a challenging year with the coronavirus. Tell us a little bit about what you feel like you've done in your year. What have been your proudest accomplishments? What are some of the challenges you feel like the ASES has overcome over the past year?
Well, you know, Peter, the amazing thing about being the president of this organization is the people in the organization. I told you that the people that really were the genesis of my career were Dr. Morey and Dr. Coalfield. And I believe that they characterize the majority of people that I know that are in the society, and they're people I just unbelievably admire, not for multiple reasons, their ethics, their morals, their skill, their knowledge, their creative ability to problem solve, their open-mindedness and discussion, their passion and their beliefs about what we do. And I think that characterizes the membership. I mean, look at what you and Rachel have done. I mean, you guys have put on 41 podcasts, and you know, this is your invention. It was your idea, and you guys produced it and promote it, and you continue to provide excellent content. And, you know, there's so many different people in our society that have these very interests that are just unbelievably talented. So the highlight is working with all these talented individuals. They're unbelievable. The accomplishments of the members are actually the accomplishments that I'd be most proud of. And they include all the committees. I asked all the committees. At the beginning of my presidential year, I sort of went through each of the committees, and I tried to make some idea about what I thought my vision was for each of the committees, and I wrote them down. And I would say that every committee exceeded anything I set forth. You know, the educational committee, I wanted them to develop something for the boards. You know, to get board recertified, you have to take a self-assessment exam that has to have so many hours. And I had a hard time finding a self-assessment exam for shoulder and elbow. They had it for sports or whatever, and I don't do any of that. So it was hard to find the right one. And so I sort of said, hey, listen, we need to have this for our members, and we should make it. And those guys did it. They made the exam. They got it approved by the board. So there will be a shoulder and elbow self-assessment made by the ASES members, for ASES members and others, of course, to get credit to get board recertification. I mean, those guys did it. They did other things too. And you know, every subcommittee sort of falls within that. Every one of them. So the other thing is, I never really quite understood this until I started the presidential line. You know, there's really smart people, and there's really people that have accomplished a lot. And then there's people that have certain specific skills in leadership. And if you watch people, you'll see that many of them have different leadership styles. Probably you and Rachel probably saw different leadership styles in your mentors and maybe in the people where you work now. And some of those leadership styles may appeal to you, some of them may not. But you know, working in the executive committee or the presidential line, it's amazing. I mean, I got to work with people that I really didn't know very well. And I learned a tremendous amount from Frank Cordesco. He's an amazing leader. Bill Levine is so talented and bright. Javier Duralde and Peter McDonald, all those guys are amazing. And the staff at ASCS, likewise. I mean, they're incredible. I mean, they really are really smart and really care. And, you know, they don't look at the clock. They're very committed to helping us have a society that reflects our values and also encourage us to improve our ability to care for our patients. Those would be the great accomplishments. I think the challenge, of course, and the thing that stressed me out the most was the annual meeting. And you know, we made the decision to postpone it because the COVID numbers in Tampa were at an all-time high. And I had a breakthrough infection and several of my colleagues had breakthrough infections. And I just was worried that if I invited all my friends to Tampa, that they would have breakthrough infections. I didn't think that would be too appropriate. So I made the decision, and the members of the planning committee made it with me because they're all from Florida, Dr. Mile and John Leedy and Derek Cuff, and they saw the same thing. But then we had to find a new time and a new venue, and oh my God, that was unbelievable. But we do have a new time and venue. It's December 15th to the 17th. There's been a lot of people that have helped with that, and it's definitely been that's been the greatest challenge by far is trying to make sure we have that meeting. And you know, the importance of the meeting, I think, is multi-layered. The first thing is, you know, it's easy to sort of forget why we have meetings because in this era of COVID, we've gotten away from meetings. And, you know, people might think, well, we go to meetings to learn. Well, I think that's partially true. But I really think we go to meetings to connect. I mean, there's very few, at least my belief is, there's very few people that know what the feeling is when they had a bad complication. Or, on the other hand, when they did an operation that they were just so happy with of how it went. It was so thrilling to them, so successful. And when I'm in a meeting like our meetings, I'm pretty confident that emotionally the people who I'm talking to, they know exactly what I'm feeling because they feel it too. And it's that shared feeling, that feeling of connecting to what happens in our lives that relate to our professional career, that really, I think, is the essence of why we have these meetings. So I'm glad that we're having the meeting. I think it will allow us during these difficult times to share some of the triumphs and some of the defeats that we've had to endure during this time period.
I think that's so important that we do that. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more that, you know, we lose so much over Zoom. I mean, you can still hear someone present their most recent research, but I agree with you that you lose so much of the soul of the meeting in terms of the connections you make and the friends you've had and the ways in which they help us to really enrich ourselves. I mean, I feel like that's for me. I go to a meeting and I return feeling recharged. You know, I feel like I've regained so much of what I came to the profession for to begin with. So that collegiality, it's one of the things that I think is so great about our society. So I think we all owe you a little bit of a debt because I'm sure that canceling the meeting and rescheduling it for a couple months later has been like a tripling amount of the amount of work that you would otherwise would have done. And well, I think we all will appreciate coming together in December. I mean,
well, I sure hope so. I mean, you know, there's a lot of discussion about it's not the right time because it's near the holiday and there's conflict with other meetings. And we just really tried to find the time and it was so difficult. And, you know, I guess I did a fair amount of work. And I would measure the work by time on the phone and thinking about it. But it was a pretty anxiety provoking, and it still is, because, you know, I don't want to have people upset in general. And, you know, this is not a uniformly like, yay, 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 perfect time. And I recognize that. And so that part has been stressful, because I don't want to disappoint anyone. And certainly this date probably is going to disappoint few, because there are some conflicts and there are some issues. But I'm hoping that it will still really work out to be a great meeting. And I'm really excited that we're having it, and think it will really be something that we'll all find beneficial.
Yeah, I would echo Pete and say I think we do all owe you a huge debt, that just your decision and the society's decision to make that investment early and to allow people to plan their life, I think is something that is just, it's a big challenge for so many reasons, but it's so helpful that you guys decided to do that in a timely fashion. And I think everyone is so appreciative, and I couldn't agree more with what Pete said. I think the being at meetings is nice, because we get that social atmosphere that we've just missed for so long over the last year, and that we crave, and that it's great to, you know, have a drink and talk to our friends and the colleagues and mentors and trainees. So thank you for that. And speaking of trainees, I want to transition now to talking a little bit about a topic that I know is near and dear to all of us, and that's training trainees, training fellows. And you have a significant amount of experience with, and Pete and I were both wondering, what is your favorite and least favorite part about training fellows?
When they start is my least favorite, and when they leave, no, when they leave is my least favorite. When they leave is my least favorite, because, you know, just right when they leave, they're almost, you know, they're like family, and you're just so, you're like, you get each other. It's just so like right there, and then they leave, and you're like this void, and now you get the new group, and the new group's cool. You get to learn all about them, and you know, they're all so different from the old group, and now you got to sort of figure out how each of them is going to teach you. You know, it's funny, you think about, I'm the teacher, right? And I recognize often the benefit of teaching is you get to learn the most. That's, I think, the dirty secret. And each of the people that I've had the honor and privilege to train, they've all taught me a great deal in various different ways. You know, they're people, they have different life stories, different life experiences. And those different experiences, we sometimes don't realize how much more we can learn from interacting with people that actually have different experiences than us.
So let me tag on to that, because when we talk about fellows and we talk about trainees, many of our listeners here are either active fellows or recently graduated fellows and are surgeons early in their careers. What advice do you have for those surgeons just beginning out? And I think particularly in 2021, moving into 2022, with a lot of changes in our healthcare system and in society in general, medicine now is different than what it was even 5 years ago, let alone 10 to 20 years ago. What advice do you have for our younger listeners, for our newer surgeons out there?
Well, thanks, Rachel, for that question. So the first thing is, I think one of the this is one of aspects of human nature that I probably learned from my wife, that we all tend to do. We tend to think of our life in terms of our past experiencing and what that made us feel like, imagining that our future experiences will sort of feel similar when we do certain things, right? So the idea that we basically behave in a way because we anticipate it's going to make us feel a certain way. Okay, now, what that means is you might finish your fellowship program and imagine that how you'll feel will be reflective on the type of practice. Maybe you want your practice to be like the person who you trained for, right? And you're imagining, if I have my practice just like the person who trained me, I'm going to feel like he feels or she feels, right? But the truth is, how you are going to feel is probably so much dependent upon your internal view of yourself and how you decide what's important and what's not. And the truth is, that's likely to change. So, you know, it's easy to get sort of hung up on things that seem like they're really important. like, how am I going to get paid? Which isn't somewhat important. But in general, if you take care of people well, you're likely at some point to be compensated pretty reasonably. And then there's these other internal pressures that we put upon ourselves in terms of how productive we are, how many surgeries we do, or how many papers we publish, or whatever it is that you set for yourself. And, you know, I guess I'd say, just realize that, you know, this thing that we're in called life is this journey, and you keep trying to imagine you'll get to a place and you'll feel a certain way. And I'd say, think about how you feel now. Think about the things that make you feel like that you really feel good about. Maybe not happy, but fulfilled. Maybe you're not necessarily always looking to be happy, but maybe you're trying to have a sense of fulfillment or gratification that, you know, you put yourself up to a challenge that you thought was worthwhile. And just by doing that, you can feel grateful, because oftentimes it's much easier to take the easier route and not put yourself through things that are uncomfortable or challenging.
I wanted to ask you about that. I think that's a super interesting insight, that you should, instead of trying to think about what will make you satisfied in the future, think about what makes you satisfied now. So how did you mentioned that you did these research fellowships and realized that you had this curiosity and you really wanted to discover new knowledge. Did you at that time think, I'm going to discover something new and I'm going to feel different? Or did you then say,
It was never about that. It was always about, oh, well, this is sort of interesting. This is a problem. And I want to try to figure out how I can improve this problem. And it's funny, because now, you know, I've obviously been very much involved in implant design and development. And I work with a lot of really smart and talented individuals, and they think very, very much differently than I do. And again, it's really easy, at least for me, maybe I'm the only one. When people think differently, especially about something that you're very passionate about, the first response I typically have is, well, they're wrong. And, you know, I would say I really try to take that voice in my head that I'm hearing that and just try to disregard it, because it's not about wrong or right. As much as we like being right and not being wrong, it's more about, well, what things are interesting? What things can you learn that are interesting? Because that's actually a lot easier to manage emotionally. Because the wrong and the right has all that emotion about how you feel about yourself involved, where if you're just going about things that are interesting to you, there's no losing in that, right? You can't lose in that fashion, because it's just, you're just curious, oh, that's sort of cool. Like, these guys think this way. It's totally different than I would have thought. It's a lot more fun when you just can learn all these different things. And if you open your mind to listening to differences, at least for me, I tend to find it pretty gratifying, but it does require, at least for me, continuous self-work.
Certainly, I think that's such valuable advice. Maybe that's the biggest pearl our listeners can take, is don't think about right and wrong. Think about what's interesting, or maybe for people who tell you something different, why do you think that? How do I get inside of whatever it is that you're thinking?
Yeah, I think that's that idea of critical thinking, Peter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really the core of it there. On a less serious note, there's one question we've asked a lot of people on the podcast that you might have heard, which is, if you could have dinner with any person from history, who would you have dinner with, and where would you have dinner?
Oh, wow. Well, I might have heard that and have not. Oh, man. Oh, there's a lot there. I have to think about that. Yeah, I don't know. Man, that's a tough one. I could probably tell you where I'd want to eat. I'd probably want to eat deep dish Chicago pizza. So that part's sort of easy.
My man.
Which deep dish place? Yeah, which deep dish place you're going to?
Yeah, there's a big family discrepancy in my family. So I grew up in Chicago, and there's Lou Malnati's and there was a Gino's, and I was introduced to deep dish pizza in a restaurant called Gino's East. It was on Superior, right off of Michigan Avenue. My cousin took me there when I was like 8 or 9, and I ate this stuff. And I woke up the next morning and I ate it for breakfast. And he sort of teased me about it, but that was like that memory and that emotional connection sort of still resonates every time I eat that pizza. And so any deep dish Chicago pizza sort of would be where I'd go. There's so many people that to have dinner with. I mean, there's the politicians and the scientists, and then there's be family members that I never got to meet, my grandparents, for example. That would probably be things that I would want to know about. There's just so many. I don't know. That's sort of an overwhelming question. I really like to read, so maybe some authors, but I can't tell you one person, so I'll pass on that one. Sorry.
Give us a couple authors. I'm a big reader too. I'd love to hear what you like to read.
Oh God. Well, so you can start like one of my, you know, if you like psychology, you know, Danny Kahneman is a really interesting guy. Him and Amos Tversky sort of introduced the idea of behavioral economics, and Kahneman won the Nobel Prize. And he's written one of his big books was Thinking Fast and Slow or something like that. I can't remember the title, but that was a really good book. There was another guy I really liked, a political theorist named Francis Fukuyama. And he wrote something about the political development from prehistoric man to the French Revolution. That was unbelievable. And those are, obviously nonfiction. And then there's a host of fiction writers. I like, there's a Daniel Silva who writes about, he has this Alon, Gabriel Alon, who's a sort of a Mossad agent, who's an art historian, who's really good. And there's this one author, and I'm looking him up because I want to make sure I get him right, because he actually is really one of my favorite. He has a new book coming out in a little bit. I might take too long to say, but right now I'm listening to a great book by a Colston Whitehead called Harlem Shuffle.
Well, I'm sorry to stress you with that question. Rachel and I both enjoy that question because it we get such a huge variety of answers from different people, and because I think it's such a it's nice to have people talk a little bit about the things they enjoy, and people give such fascinating answers.
Don Winslow, that's it. I was blanking on his name. Don Winslow he's an awesome writer. I've read everything by him. He's really, but there's a ton of other ones.
Well, I'll have to go check that out. That sounds fascinating. I wanted to thank you on, you know, behalf of the ASCS for the work you've done as president, and thank you behalf of the field for the work you've done to drive our thinking forward when it comes to reverse total charlotteplasty, in addition to the many other contributions you've made. And also obviously for spending the last hour or so with us to tell us about it. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you both. Thank you for the excellent work you've done for 41 podcasts. So that's at least 41 hours that you and Rachel have spent, not to mention the hours you spent editing and thinking of the questions and doing this. So I'm really grateful to have you guys as members of society, and you exemplify what our society really is about. So thanks again.
Well, that's about all the time we have for this podcast. Thank you so much again to our guest, the one and only Dr. Frankel. For all our shoulder and elbow listeners out there, please don't forget to subscribe. And for Pete Chalmers, I'm Rachel Frank, and we'll see you next time.